And welcome to Radio Times. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is headed for the Middle East to help broker a ceasefire between Israel and Gaza. She is scheduled to meet with leaders in Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Cairo. She will not meet with Hamas, considered a terrorist organization by the United States. Tension between Israel and Gaza has escalated in recent days after Israel launched punishing airstrikes in an effort to stop rocket attacks against its territory. It killed a top Hamas military commander and more than 100 Palestinians. Three Israelis have died in the fighting. Today on Radio Times, what does this renewed violence mean for Gaza, Israel, the region, and the United States? And we begin our conversation with Ernesto Londoño, who covers the Pentagon for the Washington Post and is in Tel Aviv. And Ernesto, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be with you.
Has there been fighting today? And by that, I mean rocket launches and airstrikes?
Yes, it's been a fairly intensive day. It's the seventh day of this operation, so it's entering its ending its first week. And there's been a fair amount of fighting on both sides. So even as this talk of a ceasefire is the issue that everybody's focusing on, folks on the ground are fighting pretty intensely today. We've seen we saw a volley of fire of rocket fire launched from Gaza towards southern Israel today. There was a long-range rocket fired that landed in the outskirts of Jerusalem near a Palestinian area, which showed us that militants there can still fire pretty long-range rockets that have become sort of game-changers in this conflict. And the Israeli military has continued to pursue targets in Gaza, launching airstrikes. And just minutes ago, they've been dropping leaflets over Gaza, warning citizens to leave their homes in certain areas that presumably will be struck, and to gather in the center of Gaza City, where the Israeli military says they will be safer. So both parties in the conflict are still fighting pretty aggressively, even as negotiators in Cairo and folks here in Israel are trying to avert an escalation.
And when those Palestinians are told to leave their homes, as you said, they're going to the center of Gaza. What is there to protect them from air assaults?
That's a very good question, because the bombardment has been very intense and has been pretty widespread. You know, we've seen civilian buildings targeted. We saw two buildings that are used by media organizations, and that the Israeli military has also served as a hub for terror groups and for militants. We've seen the bombardment of a residential home where 10 members of a family, including 4 kids, died. So I think the picture we're getting from people in Gaza is that there's really nowhere to hide. There might be some areas that are presumed to be safer than others. For example, hospitals and schools and places like those. You know, people are reasonably certain that they won't be bombed there. But when it comes to residential areas and just the, you know, sort of the densely populated areas, you know, it seems like all bets are off. It seems like the message from Israel is if you're close to a Hamas leader or a Hamas member, you might be at risk. And the truth of the matter is, you know, pretty much everybody in Gaza knows a Hamas leader is related to a Hamas leader or Hamas member. It's really, really hard to make choices where you're going to be safe there now.
We're reading, and you included this in some of your reporting from the region, that something like 107 Palestinians have been killed, and that does include this Hamas military leader. But I'm curious, how many of those are civilians?
That's a very good question, and it's a question I think that will take some time to get an answer for, because a lot of the militants in Gaza sort of lead dual lives. They can be farmers during the day and be engaged in militancy to varying degrees at night on their spare time, et cetera. So, you know, when it comes to sort of differentiating between civilians and militants there, it's always been a very tricky proposition and a very controversial one. So, you know, I think it's going to take some time. And at the end of the day, we might never know truly of the people who have been killed in this offensive, how many of them were actual fighters and how many of them were just bystanders.
Does anyone, and these rocket attacks from Gaza into Israel have been going on for months, if not years now. From your reporting, why has that happened and who has been behind it? Has it been Hamas, in a sense, calling the shots?
Well, Hamas actually, you know, up to this operation, Hamas had been trying to maintain a ceasefire. The problem, though, or at least had been committed to maintaining a ceasefire nominally. The problem, though, is there are other militant groups that are more hardline, they're more hardcore, that are far more aggressive in wanting to push back on what they see as Israel's blockade and its occupation of Palestinian lands, and think that the most effective way of doing it is by lobbing rockets, which is really, at this point, the only weapon at hand that they have, the only thing they can do to engage Israel militarily, because it is an asymmetrical conflict when it comes to the weaponry and sort of the skills that each side has. So after Israel last Wednesday, when after one of the senior Hamas commanders, the ceasefire and any notion of it evaporated, and we learned that Hamas has been stockpiling, you know, pretty impressive weapons, including long range rockets that are capable of reaching Tel Aviv and Israel, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. So that really put a huge percentage of the Israeli population sort of, you know, within the firing line, and that changed the stakes of the equation. But, you know, as for the motive, as for why militants there see these rockets as effective tools, you know, they say that they feel like they're trapped, like they're sort of in a prison. They're not members of a state. They can't travel freely. Their lives are very limited. And they point to Israel as sort of the reason behind all these factors that have limited their lives so much. And the only way they see they can push back on it is by firing rockets and resisting is what they call it.
And where are they getting these rockets? Are they being sent to the region, or are they being sent in pieces to the region and then built there?
The Israeli military says that some of the more sophisticated pieces of artillery that we've been seeing, specifically these long-range rockets, are being produced and smuggled, withheld from Iran. That's a claim Iran denies. But I think a lot of these are sort of homemade rockets. There's, you know, people in Gaza have been in this game for a very long time, and they've become specialists. So you see everything from very basic pieces of artillery with short range that can only really strike sort of across the border into the southern Israeli towns, to rockets with very long reach, you know, mm-hmm. 45 miles plus. So these new rockets, according to the Israeli government, are coming from Iran or being produced with a financial support of Iran, and they're being smuggled in through Sudan and later through Egypt.
And I hope we didn't lose you. We have a kind of a funky phone line now to Tel Aviv, talking with Ernesto Londoño, who covers the Pentagon for the Washington Post, and frankly getting us up to speed on the conflict in the region and what has been going on in terms of airstrikes and rocket launches. And I do want to ask you, Ernesto, about this ceasefire. And we know that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is on her way to the region. Ban Ki-moon is there now. What is the status of the ceasefire?
Well, the ceasefire would be a deal probably brokered by Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. And at this point, there's a lot of speculation that a deal could come as early as tonight. That's something that a lot of Israelis and, frankly, a lot of Palestinians would like to see. But the devil's in the detail, because the sides haven't really sort of reached or voiced an agreement on what conditions need to be set in order for the firing to stop. Hamas says that it wants Israel to suspend its campaign and to stop its bombardment, and Israel says it wants Hamas to stop launching rockets and to agree to stop producing and stockpiling these weapons. So people are very wary of reaching sort of the kind of truce that has been reached in the past, where people essentially just cease firing and everybody just kind of retreats and takes a step back and then gets ready for the next conflict, except this time you have a lot more, you know, grievances to avenge. So I think what all the stakeholders, including the United Nations and the United States, by sending Secretary Clinton here, are trying to do is come up with a framework that leads to a durable solution. But durable solutions in this region have been very elusive and are very, very tough because these grievances date back to many, many decades. There's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of anger, and there's a lot of blood that has been spilled on both sides. And that makes you know, sort of trust building and any sort of pact that parties will deem credible and will sort of walk away happily with very, very tough.
Well, and even looking at more present day, how much do you think the Arab Spring has changed both the dynamics, the political dynamics in the region, and the alliances?
I think enormously. I think you see an Arab world, primarily when you consider Egypt, that is ideologically a lot more closely aligned with Hamas. When this operation began, we saw President Morsi dispatch senior Egyptian government officials to Hamas in sort of a show of support. But, you know, on the other hand, we're still seeing, you know, even though the new Egyptian government is an Islamist government, is ideologically aligned with Hamas, we're still seeing them be sort of constructive brokers. We still see them have a constructive dialogue with the Israeli government. The Egyptian intelligence service has a long-standing relationship with Israel, and during this operation, they've been able to sort of have an open line of dialogue with both parties. I think on the one hand, Hamas and allied groups in the Gaza Strip feel emboldened. They feel a lot more support from their Arab neighbors. We had a huge, 100-strong delegation of Egyptians that essentially burst into Gaza in a show of support in the last couple of days. That would have been unheard of during the government of former President Hosni Mubarak. So I think they feel like they have a lot more political cover. They have a lot more support. It sort of raises the stake for Israel. If Israel is seen as having overreached, if they've seen as having been overly aggressive, it could really significantly deepen its isolation in the neighborhood, because a lot of these states that in the past have sort of have not been as vocal and have not been as staunch supporters of the past. At this point, politically, stand to do so.
Well, you know what? We have to say goodbye. Ernesto Londoño, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he covers the Pentagon for the Washington Post. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. As part of a citywide celebration of Frank Furness on the anniversary of his death, PAFA is exhibiting architectural drawings of the Furness-designed historic landmark building. On view through December 30th, these rare drawings document the evolution of this historical building. More information online at pafa.org or by phone at 215-972-7600.
Next time in Studio 360, faking photographs during the century and a half before Photoshop.
And they usually would say, well, this is very interesting, but this is not photography. And I think, you know, I buy everything at the camera store. I spend long hours in the darkroom. What are we going to call it?
Plus the Canadian band Cold Specs. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
A roller coaster stock market has many Americans pulling their money off Wall Street, and that worries economic gurus, including Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Robin Farzad.
A whole generation of investors is kind of bringing on heartbreak by acting the way it is now.
The danger of Generation Sell, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the fighting that has erupted once again in the Middle East between Israel and Gaza. Talking about what has been driving this conflict between Israel and Gaza. Also, the prospects for a diplomatic resolution, maybe even a resumption of peace talks. And we have two more guests who have joined us on Radio Times. We just said goodbye to Ernesto Londoño. Joining us from Brookings is Khaled El-Gindi. He's a fellow with the Saban Center for the Middle East Policy at Brookings Institution, served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on the permanent status negotiations with Israel. That was from 2004 to 2009. Also was a key participant in the recent round of negotiations launched at Annapolis in November 2007, although not so recent. That was 5 years ago. Khaled El-Gindi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Daniel Kurtzer, professor of Middle Eastern Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. During his 29-year career in the U.S. Foreign Service, he served as U.S. Ambassador to Egypt and U.S. Ambassador to Israel, and he's has a new book called Pathways to Peace, America and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. And Ambassador Kurtzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Let me begin with you, if I could. How different or not different is this conflict between Israel and Gaza from the conflict of 4 years ago?
Well, there are some remarkable similarities with respect to the military engagement, but I think the motivation on the part of Hamas is quite different from what it was several years ago. Several years ago, the message was directed primarily at Israel to lift the blockade or the siege. Hamas was very frustrated that the truce that had existed before that war was not leading to any kind of a reduction of pressure, and thought that using force would force Israel's hand. This time around, you have some of that same motivation, but you have a very different situation on the ground. Hamas has enjoyed diplomatic and financial support from Qatar. The Emir of Qatar just visited and pledged $400 million, support from Turkey, and support from the new Muslim Brotherhood-led government in Egypt. So there's a sense of some growing political strength on Hamas's part, and it's in my view, one of the reasons that led them to believe that an escalation in the violence this time could actually yield some substantial political gains, which in fact may be the case.
What do you think, Khaled?
I think Ambassador Kurtzer is absolutely right. On the ground, it looks very similar, although we haven't yet seen the enormous scale of death and destruction that we saw in 4 years ago, although that may still come. But politically, the entire situation has changed. In late 2008, when this began, there was actually negotiations going on between Israelis and Palestinians. Today, of course, the peace process is dead. Mm-hmm. At that time, President Hosni Mubarak was the president of Egypt, and you had a very different regional picture than you have today. And the entire political situation and regional environment has changed to Hamas's advantage. But the diplomatic tools available to Israel and to the United States and other actors have not changed. And I think that is really why we're in this situation. You have United States that is pretty much disengaged, but the extent to which it's engaged, it's using these completely outdated policies and irrelevant mechanisms and ideas that simply don't apply to realities on the ground anymore. So when we hear a report that Secretary Clinton is going out to the region to broker an agreement between a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, what exactly does that mean when the United States can't talk to one of the sides? So what sort of a role is that?
Well, let me pick up on that, and I'll put that to you, Ambassador Kurtzer. Should Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sit down with Hamas leadership?
Well, Khaled is exactly right that if, in fact, she's going with the expectation that she's going to be brokering the ceasefire, then it's going to be a unhappy trip. I think, however, that given the fact that we know that President Obama and President Morsi of Egypt have been on the phone quite a good deal, I think the Secretary's trip is designed for another purpose, which is to, in a sense, shore up the back of Prime Minister Netanyahu and maybe give him a little bit of a push. In other words, to say to him, we have stood with you during this conflict and we'll continue to stand with you, but it's now time to move this thing forward. I think, second, the fact that she's going to Ramallah on this trip is actually a long overdue reminder that the real potential loser as a result of all of this may be the PLO and the PA, the Palestinian Authority, which is standing on the sidelines looking totally ineffective. So I don't think she's going to negotiate a ceasefire because she really can't. She doesn't talk to Hamas. And at this point, I think it would be counterproductive to start a dialogue. But I think she's going essentially to give a little encouragement, let's call it, to the Israeli side to cut the deal.
Hala, do you think the PLO and the Palestinian Authority are bystanders to this conflict?
Oh, absolutely. I think Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, is the single biggest loser, other than, of course, the people on the ground. He is the biggest loser in this, and he's been marginalized for years by the Israelis and by the Americans, but he's also done a great deal to marginalize himself. He could have taken the initiative. He could have gone to Gaza, just like Arab leaders went to Gaza. He is supposedly the president of all Palestinians, and not just in the West Bank. But he hasn't, it's not really his style to show that kind of leadership, but he is becoming increasingly irrelevant. But one of the problems, I think, with this approach that the United States has been pursuing, and Israel, is in dealing with the Gaza and Hamas situation separately from the Palestinian situation in the West Bank, as though Gaza and Hamas were somehow outside of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as though Hamas was not a Palestinian actor that affects Palestinian politics, that affects, of course, directly Israel. So dealing on two separate tracks in that way is one of the reasons why we're in this situation. It's created this huge imbalance between the two Palestinian sides, and there needs to be a single coherent Palestinian actor. So that means Palestinians have to be allowed to create that coherent political entity, and this policy of not allowing Palestinians to unify or punishing Palestinians if they pursue reconciliation is completely counterproductive and irrational.
Daniel Kurtzer, one of the things that I was reading about in preparation for this show is that, and looking at what Israel is doing in terms of its airstrikes in Gaza as a kind of a dress rehearsal for Iran, testing out the region, destroying some of the infrastructure in Gaza. Does that make sense to you?
Well, in one respect, yes, although I think they've done other dress rehearsals for Iran. There was a very large U.S.-Israeli military exercise in October that, of course, the United States would not bill as a dress rehearsal for Iran, but that certainly included components of military capabilities that Israel wanted to test. I think if you also look back at the attack that the Israelis made on a Sudan reported arms factory, it's probable that that was a place either that was a way station for Iranian arms or that may have been a place where some of those arms were being assembled before transshipment to Gaza. So, yeah, in a big picture way, this does impact on Israel's Iran policy. But if you think about the way Israel responds to challenges like those of the Hamas missiles, they are very much focused on today's problem. Iran may be in the back of their minds, but they have to address the concerns of, you know, upwards of a million people living in an area that is now covered by Hamas rockets, and that's the top item on their agenda.
And that's Daniel Kurtzer, professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He's a former ambassador to Egypt and ambassador to Israel, editor of a new book called Pathways to Peace, America and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Also with us is Khaled El-Gindi, fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're talking about this renewed violence between Israel and Gaza and what it means for the region and what it means for the prospects of not just a ceasefire, but perhaps even peace. Let me see what Elliot from Falcroft has to say. Elliot, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good show. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask the guest if he feels that the Palestinians, everything that's been going on for many years, the Palestinian people can still trust the world, the UN, the Israelis, in reference to the agreements that have been made, and nothing's come of that.
And
I'll take the response off the air.
Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Khaled, do you want to take that? The issue of trust?
The issue of trust, obviously, is very important. I think Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, have felt abandoned by the world for a very long time. And the last Gaza war in late 2008, early 2009, was emblematic of that, where Israel was allowed to carry out this massive military campaign for several weeks, and there were UN meetings, and there was ceasefire talks and negotiations happening, a lot of diplomatic activity, but at the end of the day, nothing happened. There was no outside intervention. So Palestinians do feel abandoned. And that's why it's so important, this new development of Arab leaders going to Gaza and showing solidarity, which is the least that can be done at this point, and in some cases maybe the most that they can do, since certainly no Arab leader is going to take Israel on militarily. But I think this is one thing that's new is Palestinians don't, at least in Gaza, maybe don't feel as totally abandoned as they have.
But if this issue of trust, as our caller asked, Khaled, and if there is frustration about the lack of progress, whose fault is that? That's a big question.
It is a big question, and I think there's plenty of blame to go all the way around. I think all actors, including Hamas, including Israel, the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank, the United States, the Europeans, everybody has made mistakes in this process. The question, it's a matter of leadership and vision. Simply leaving the parties to themselves to, you know, this, we hear this formula often from the administration that we can't want peace more than the parties. And it's not really about wanting peace. It's about being able to get it. So both sides are going to behave. Israelis are going to behave the way Israelis do, and Palestinians are going to behave the way Palestinians do. If they could solve it on their own, they would have by now. But it's up to outside actors to change the dynamic between the two conflicting parties, and that's what diplomacy is about. This kind of hands-off, laissez-faire approach to diplomacy that the United States has been exercising simply isn't working.
Well, to you, Daniel Kurtzer, is there something different that the U.S. should do? We're certainly seeing some of the Arab countries get more involved in the region. We're seeing Egypt take a leading role in this particular conflict. What carrots and sticks does the United States have?
Well, Marty, the reason that we did the book that you mentioned in the introduction, Pathways to Peace, with an introduction by Secretary of State James Baker and former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, was to remind the United States that this is a national interest of our country. It's not a favor we do for the parties. Khaled is exactly right. We can want peace, at least as much as the parties. And if it is in our interests, then we ought to do something about it. We've had only episodic moments in the past 10 years of U.S. engagement. And it's been rather weak engagement. And so what 12 authors in this book basically argue, even though they differ on some tactics, is the idea that the United States needs a strong policy and a strong and determined commitment to pursue that policy, not simply to argue, let's get to negotiations, but to actually have a policy that says, we kind of know where this thing is going, as do the parties. It's been identified in negotiations in the past. Let's move in that direction as we build the institutions of the Palestinian statehood, as we bring in the Arab world as part of the Arab Peace Initiative, as we enforce the roadmap, which requires changes of behavior on the ground. In other words, an across-the-board approach with a very determined American diplomatic backing.
But how can you force parties to do what they have been reluctant to do in the past?
You know, we're still the United States, and we do tough things. It doesn't mean that you bang people over the heads. But, you know, you mentioned in your question carrots and sticks. I prefer incentives and disincentives.
Fair enough.
We have a lot of incentives, certainly with the State of Israel, which we support rather grandly with respect to both security and economic assistance. And building coalitions with the Arab world and with Europe, we also have a lot of leverage to play with the Palestinians, including helping Mahmoud Abbas make decisions that are very hard for him to make. So there's no single wave of the wand here where, you know, we say go to the table and they go to the table. But it's persistent, concerted diplomacy, and it's something that we have done in the past, and we can do it.
Well, Khaled El-Gindi, you've been an advisor to Palestinian negotiations with Israel. What advice do you have for the United States?
Well, I agree with Dan. We can't, the United States has a lot of leverage, and we can't, one thing that we cannot do and cannot allow others to do is to behave in ways that are completely counterproductive. So allowing a military operation to go on for 6 days as it has consequences. The logic of military force only creates more military force. So if you're going to deal with the issue militarily, then the other side is going to see that as their only option. They're not going to be beaten into submission. So simply saying that Israel has the right to defend itself and allowing it to carry out this hugely disproportionate sort of attack with well over 100 fatalities on the Palestinian side, people need to remember that there are consequences to that. So people will live with that. They will carry that into the next round of diplomacy or the next conflict, and we can't simply allow it to perpetuate. That's not leadership. And I think the United States missed a very big opportunity in ignoring this or simply letting it happen for as long as it has.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also, some callers that want to join the conversation as well. That's Khaled El-Gindi, fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and he has worked as a Palestinian negotiator. Daniel Kurtzer, professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and to Israel, and editor of a book called Pathways to Peace, America and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY and announces the 2012 We Remember Gala, this year honoring the Wistar Institute, Friday, November 30th from 6 to 9 p.m. For more than 20 years, Philadelphia Fight has worked to combat HIV through research, treatment, prevention, and education. The We Remember Gala serves as a reminder that HIV remains a challenge and also honors those lost to the disease. For tickets and details, 215-525-8628 or fight.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Vogue's creative director, Grace Coddington, who you may have seen in the documentary The September Issue. She was a model in London in the 60s when that city was at the center of youth fashion. A car accident that smashed her face interrupted her modeling career. She's been at Vogue since 1988 when Anna Wintour became editor-in-chief. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. With tax deductions on the chopping block to avoid that fiscal cliff, what will it mean for household budgets to lose deductions like mortgage interest or charitable giving? Also, 3 weeks after Sandy, we visit residents of a New Jersey town with no power, no heat, some no homes. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about what the renewed violence between Israel and Gaza means for those two territories, or one a country and one a part of the Palestinian state, their neighbors, as well as for U.S. foreign policy. And again, Khaled El-Gindi and Daniel Kurtz are our guests. Let's see what Rick from Hokes in Delaware has to say. And Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Wonderful show, and
Thank you. And so timely. Thank you.
I'm currently reading a book called Setting the Desert on Fire about T.E. Lawrence in 1916 and the great powers getting involved. And my question is, people always mention the Israeli blockade of Gaza, but it's not a one-dimensional blockade. It's a two-dimensional blockade. Egypt also is enforcing a blockade. They did it very much under Mubarak. And I wondered what your speakers, why is it always portrayed as a one-dimensional blockade when Egypt is on the southern border of Gaza? And I'll take my question, and all that that implies, and I'll take my question off the air.
It's a good question, Rick. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Daniel Kurtzer, let me put that first to you. Does he have a point?
Yeah, he's right. Egypt under Mubarak contributed to the blockade or the siege, and it was a cause of great frustration. It's, of course, easier for Hamas to take out their anger on the Israelis than on a sister Arab state. The problem became a little bit less acute, though, after Mubarak was deposed, because the government of Egypt began a period of greater opening hours for passenger transit between Gaza and Egypt. The concern now is that there still is not an opening for commercial goods, which forces all of that stuff underground into the tunnels. So the caller is exactly right. Egypt is part of the problem here, as well as part of the solution, and that's what makes these ceasefire negotiations more complicated than simply having two parties with a mediator. Egypt will have a role to play in actually figuring out how to open up that border while maintaining its own security, because after all, over the past 2 years, the Sinai Peninsula, which borders Gaza, has become a hotbed of instability as arms and terrorists leaving Gaza have used Sinai to launch attacks not only against Israel, but also against Egypt.
Well, and Khaled El-Gindi, just underscoring how volatile that region is.
Well, I think Dan's right. There certainly are security issues in Sinai, and obviously the spillover from Gaza doesn't help. And the Egyptians have their own interests in keeping a lid on the situation there. But there's a bigger picture here, and that is Gaza is not a viable entity by itself. It's not economically viable. It even barely, from a subsistence humanitarian standpoint, it is barely livable. In fact, there was a report recently that in a decade or so, Gaza might even be completely unlivable. I mean, the water quality that people are drinking is salinated and polluted, and it's just simply not livable. Gaza has to be part of a Palestinian state, and it has to be connected to the rest of the world. So the blockade, I think, is meaningful. The Israeli side of the blockade is enforced by air, land, and sea. So nothing can come in to Gaza by sea, even. Gaza does not have control over its own ports, as we've seen from flotilla incidences in the past, folks trying to reach Gaza. So there isn't very much an Israeli blockade. The Egyptians do not want to inherit the Gaza Strip. I think Israel would like nothing more than for Egypt to open the border completely with the Gaza Strip and have Gaza be an Egyptian problem. The Egyptians are pushing back, both under Mubarak and the current government, because they don't want to absorb Palestinians for two reasons. They don't want it's obviously a demographic and a security issue from their standpoint as Egypt as a sovereign state, but also it would completely destroy any hope of a Palestinian state. So it's not entirely that Egypt is enforcing a blockade. It's slightly more nuanced.
Well, and going back to you, Daniel Kircher, then we'll get back to our callers. Just looking at the ceasefire, if it's able to be brokered, and we're not even talking about peace talks yet, would that include then some kind of opening of this blockade in exchange for Hamas or Gaza stopping these rocket attacks into Israel?
Well, it certainly is going to be part of Hamas's demands, and it's going to be one of the toughest issues for Israel to swallow. They don't want to deliver an easy political victory to Hamas, and some kind of a regular opening of the Egyptian border would be a political victory, because Hamas could tell the Palestinian people that they've now kind of regularized their status with respect to travel and commerce. On the other hand, Israel does have a demand that the tunnels be destroyed, and they may counter-propose that if the Rafah border opening takes place, that Egypt undertake a commitment to destroy those tunnels, so at least not only the commerce moves over ground, but also the smuggling of weapons moves over ground to be under Egyptian supervision.
Let me see what John from Hamilton, New Jersey, has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. This is John. I guess I'd start off by saying I don't support the radical Hamas or the radical Israelis. But a perspective from the island conflict between the IRA and England may be helpful. Those troubles ended not because the British Army enforced a boundary between the two parties, but because the Irish economy improved. And so it's not in the interests of Israel to bomb the Palestinians back into the Stone Age, but it's in the interest of the international community to support moderate Palestinians and improve their lives so that the Palestinians have something to lose, that the Irish decided to send their kids to college rather than to become bombers, and the same has to happen with Palestine.
A very interesting comment, John. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Holland Elgindy, I'd be curious about your response.
I think it's true. Obviously, if the Gaza Strip is an extremely impoverished region with poor facilities, poor infrastructure, poor water, poor sanitation, poor everything. It's overcrowded. You have something like 60% unemployment, if people can wrap their brains around that. Vast majority of Gazans live off of food aid from the outside, and to introduce additional destruction into the equation, of course, will only feed desperation and more radicalism. There are groups in Gaza that have grown over these years in strength and appeal that are far more radical than Hamas. Hamas has essentially accepted the outlines of a two-state solution and are willing to sort of accommodate certain realities. Of course, there's a lot of rhetorical bluster. But at the end of the day, the point is that economics is important. But at the end of the day, there's a political solution and not a military solution. These issues have to be dealt with in an integrated way, in a holistic way. And the approach of the United States and Israel so far has not been integrated. It's been completely fragmented. So let's throw some money here. Let's allow some militarily they can be forced to submit. Maybe they could be bought off with economic prosperity. But ignoring the political dynamic is I think, ultimately the problem.
Do you agree with that, Daniel Kircher?
I would add a little more texture to it. The United States and the international community have devoted considerable resources to shoring up the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And in fact, until relatively recently, the past 6 months or so,
there was something of an economic revival in the West Bank. I don't want to get carried away. It was never great, but one could see construction back and business activity, kind of the hustle and bustle of an economy that was working. As part of that, though, there was an effort on the part of the international community to keep trying to isolate what were seen as the opponents of peace, and that's, of course, Hamas. So there was a little more subtlety to the policy than simply the punishment aspect. I think what this latest round of violence suggests, with the possibility that military winners may not actually also be the political winners, is that, as Khalid suggested earlier in the conversation, it may be time to re-examine, if not the issue of dialogue with Hamas, then at least the question of allowing reconciliation to take place between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. This has been on the agenda. There have been abortive efforts to do so, including efforts that were vetoed by the United States and the West. And it may be time to allow Abbas to explore it again. Now, it's going to be his decision whether to do it, but this may be the way to reorient things back towards Ramallah and the West Bank, and therefore back to the political process, even as the economic situation hopefully improves.
Listening to the two of you, I'm trying to imagine the two of you negotiating not just a ceasefire, but also some kind of resolution to the conflict in this region. Daniel Kurtzer?
Yeah, if Khalid and I were to do it, as you see from this conversation,
exactly,
it would be done. And in fact, Marty, if you look at past negotiations, it's not really differences over the core issues that have bedeviled those negotiations. In fact, in 2008, when both former Prime Minister Olmert and President Abbas subsequently admitted that they were very close, public opinion polling at that time on both sides suggested that there would be support for the kind of package that required both sides to make concessions. Mm-hmm. We're really talking here about political will and leadership. In 2008, unfortunately, Olmert was on his way out, and there was uncertainty about the political future of his government, and Abbas, I think, hesitated because of that. Between 2009 and 2011, I think the Obama administration tried but took some missteps that didn't help. Mm-hmm. It, you know, political will, political leadership, determination, I think can get us back in the direction of that finish line.
Do you share some of that optimism, Khalid El-Ghindi?
Well, I don't know that it's optimism. I don't know that it will happen, but I agree with Dan that it should happen. And I also agree that it is very much time to reconsider the policy of trying to isolate and weaken Hamas either militarily or through an economic siege and other means, if only because that policy has completely failed. Hamas is today much stronger politically, has more international legitimacy, has the Emir of Qatar coming to shower them with hundreds of millions, and it's the Western-backed Palestinian Authority that is on the verge of financial collapse. And actually, the United States and Israel are threatening more sanctions against Mahmoud Abbas and his government for taking a diplomatic initiative at the UN. So these are fundamental contradictions that need to be resolved. And I think the way to resolve it is to allow Palestinians to fix their own house, to become a, like any other political entity, a single coherent voice. There will be voices of opposition, voices of dissent, but at least everyone agrees on the rules of the game. Simply continuing to deal with one set of Palestinians completely separate from another and play one off of the other has created this dynamic where, you know, our guy is the one who's been weakened, and the folks that we've been trying to weaken are the ones who've been strengthened. So I absolutely think it's time to reconsider that policy.
Let me get one more caller in before we have to say goodbye. This is Bill from Chestnut Hill. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just would like to know, with the two gentlemen you have there speaking, in their heart of hearts, do you think that if Israel conceded to absolutely every demand, that would bring peace over the long haul?
every single demand you're saying, Bill?
Lift the blockade, retreat to 67 borders, facilitate the joining of the West Bank with Gaza, highways, whatever they need.
Okay, let me put that to you, Daniel Kurtzer. Go ahead.
Well, respectfully, it's not a question that needs to be answered because it's not on the table. No one, including the Egyptian government, which has been critical of Israel, and certainly not the American government, which has been supportive of Israel, is asking Israel to capitulate. Mm-hmm. Both the negotiations over a ceasefire and, in the larger sense, the negotiations that Khaled and I have been talking about are negotiations in which both sides will bring very significant interests to the table, and both sides are going to have to make concessions that are very hard in order to achieve gains that they want to achieve. For Israel, that means with respect to the Palestinians finding a different way to realize their right of return and to maintain a foothold in Jerusalem. For Palestinians, it means gaining a foothold in Jerusalem while getting Israel to concede on most, if not all, of the territory. So there's no capitulation being asked of Israel, and therefore it's not really a question that that motivates policymakers now.
Well, we have to end on that note. My thanks to both of you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Daniel Kurtzer, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Khaled El-Ghindi, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Daniel Kurtzer, professor of Middle East Policy Studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, a former ambassador to both Egypt and to Israel, and editor of a new book called Pathways to Peace, America and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. And coming up next, we'll be talking